In the name of God, Amen. I, George Friedrich Händel, considering the uncertainty of human life, do make this my will in manner following.
The composer Handel added a codicil to his will only 3 days before he died in April 1759. He left various bequests to his manservants, maids, distant relatives, even his apothecary, as well as the generous sum of £100 to a musician, the violinist and composer Matthew Dubourg. So who was this Matthew Dubourg? A man clearly held in high regard by the great Handel. Well, for the previous 30 years, Dubourg had been, to give him his full title, Chief Composer and Master of His Majesty's Music, attending the state in Ireland. In the 18th century, Ireland was of course ruled by England. King George II and later King George III may not have visited Ireland, but Dublin Castle was the administration centre for most of the ruling institutions and offices, and of course the scene for state balls and entertainments. Being director of the state band was quite a prestigious role, and it's clear that Dubourg was a superb violinist. So good, in fact, that he was celebrated in the poems of the day.
Dubourg, thy power is near divine. Sweet harmony and taste are thine. Play on, the inanimate inspire, till brutes shall gaze and fools admire. Then, in some wild and tuneless strain, play tricks and fix 'em, fools again.
Those lines come from the poem On Mr. Dubourg's Excellent Performance on the Violin, penned by poet laureate Benjamin Victor. Dubourg is perhaps best known as leader of the orchestra for the premiere of Handel's Messiah, which took place in Fishamble Street Music Hall in April 1742. But there's a great deal more to the story of Matthew Dubourg in Ireland, whose music is featured in a new CD release from the Irish Baroque Orchestra. Welcome home, Mr. Dubourg. Peter Whelan, artistic director of that ensemble, who had the vision and tenacity to research this composer at length. I asked Peter what drove him in this particular direction.
I've always been fascinated with music from this era. I remember as a child kind of walking around Fishamble Street and being really inspired by that story of Handel and kind of feeling that this is where he worked and lived for that year. And I suppose at a certain point, I started to think about my own heritage, my own background. I guess always exploring music from Germany or France or, you know, British composers or composers associated with there. But I thought it would be interesting to find out, you know, what was going on in Dublin in the 18th century. Of course, we all learn at school about Handel's Messiah being like the first big thing to happen in the 18th century in Dublin. But there were a lot of unanswered questions. There must have been something else going on. It wasn't just an isolated incident. And I was really keen to find the backstory to the musicians in Dublin at the time.
Would it have been mainly strings that were used in the orchestras?
In Dublin Castle, they had the state music, which was a bunch of musicians, probably 10 to 12, mostly string players, but a lot of them doubled other instruments as well. So it wasn't unusual for one of the violinists to suddenly go and play the flute for a bit. Or there was also occasionally oboes there, but not so often for some reason. In London, you often see oboe players, but in the Dublin court, not so much. We have a letter saying that they have a very good bassoonist and a very good cellist. So one of the pieces on the disc, this Dubourg disc, we found one aria that had obbligato bassoon and cello, so we can see that there's a really high standard there at the time.
Mm-hmm. Thrina O'Hanlon is a musicologist steeped in the music of 18th century Ireland. In her work on the Mercer's Hospital music collection, she found scores by Handel, Avison, Green, Boyce, Purcell, and many more. Dublin audiences were treated to regular performances of oratorios, calling for soloists, choirs, and orchestra. She told me about the main venues for concert life in Dublin at the time, with, as you'll hear, the sound of the dart in the distance.
There were a range of venues in Dublin, in 18th century Dublin, where music could be heard and where music was performed. So music was performed in several of the city's theatres. So apart from Fishamble Street Theatre, which is synonymous with the first performance of Messiah, music could also be heard at Smock Alley, Crow Street Theatre, Ainger Street Theatre. Music was also performed at several of the inns and taverns around the city, and these would have been the venues for meetings of music societies and music clubs, and you could expect to hear a selection of vocal and instrumental music being performed at these meetings. Music was regularly performed in a liturgical context at the city's two Anglican cathedrals, St. Patrick's and Christchurch. And music could also be heard on state occasions. And music was performed in this context by the Irish State Band of Musicians. And if there was a civic occasion, this music would have been performed by the City Band of Musicians. So there were a range of venues and a range of contexts in which music was performed in Dublin at that time.
Matthew Dubourg was leading Handel's orchestra in Dublin, and we have a very interesting document from Handel describing the orchestra, and he says how excellent the players are in Dublin, led by Matthew Dubourg. And Handel doesn't use those kind of glowing terms lightly, so he knows it's true. So he obviously had a very good band at his disposal. Over the years, many people have said that Handel was going to a backwater and he didn't know what he'd find, and Messiah is orchestrated very simply because he didn't know what he'd find there. But actually, we know now that that's not true, that he knew Dubourg, he would have been in contact with him, he would have known the high standard of people who were available. And that was a starting point for me. If the standard was so high in Dublin, what else were people listening to at the time? What kind of music making were they used to, and what music were they listening to, especially from this guy Dubourg?
Owing to the patronage of the arts by the ruling Anglo-Irish class, an active music scene was cultivated in 18th century Dublin. So concerts were taking place weekly during the season. There were many opportunities for musicians to gain employment. Dublin very much followed the cultural trends as they were emerging in London, and Dublin audiences had a desire to listen to music in the Italian Baroque style, because this style of music was seen as the ultimate in cultural taste.
But what do we know about Matthew Dubourg's origins? His father was a Mr. Isaac, a Catholic dancing master at the Stuart Court in London. He was apparently in great demand by all the young ladies in high society, and he's also known for publishing a new system of dance notation. At some stage, this Mr. Isaac took up with an Irish woman, and their son, Matthew Dubourg, was born in London in 1703.
Matthew Dubourg has a kind of a shady past. We have a few clues about where he came from. And most interestingly, recently we found a bit of information that his mother, just says, was an Irish woman. So there was some connection with Ireland with him all the time. Also, he seems to have been from perhaps a Jewish background, which is also another interesting colour in his life. Matthew Dubourg was an illegitimate son of these two. So he's born with a kind of a social disadvantage from the beginning. So it's amazing that he managed to rise to the top of courtly society. One of the first mentions we see of him is when he's a child. He was a child prodigy, and he was playing Corelli's sonatas. And he was one of the first people we see to play Vivaldi's music in London. He was a student of Geminiani, of course, who is another famous violinist who also spent a lot of time in Ireland. In fact, the two of them lived together in a house in Dame Street for a long time. But interestingly enough, there was two schools. So Geminiani was a student of Corelli, so he was introducing that kind of school of violin playing throughout Europe. But you were either team Corelli RT and Vivaldi, and the two didn't cross at all. So it was very interesting to see Dubourg was playing Vivaldi's music. Mm-hmm. And his teacher would never have done that. So actually, it might have been Dubourg who introduced Vivaldi's music to the British Isles. He certainly played it lots in theatres in London and in Dublin when he was a child. So he might have been the person who introduced Vivaldi to Ireland.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, just to think of that. Claire Duff is leader of the Irish Baroque Orchestra. I caught up with her after a concert recently, and she told me a little more about this distinction between the Corelli and Vivaldi styles of playing.
The beautiful thing about the violin was they discovered that it could emanate the voice, and so the singing style was associated with Corelli, and actually it's notated that for an audition with Corelli you needed to play a long note sustained and do a beautiful messa di voce, so it was sort of the art of using the bow very beautifully, and I suppose Vivaldi style would be more virtuosic and maybe a bit more fast.
From the Concerto in A for Two Violins by Vivaldi, or V519. Dubourg fulfilled all his early promise as a violinist. By the age of 12, he was putting on his own benefit concerts in London's Drury Lane Theatre Royal, which included some of his own concertos. He must have written quite a few, but only one has survived, the Concerto in D for solo violin.
Dubourg is a better master in his way than any of the King's musicians in England, and is really the best performer of an Englishman that has ever yet been known.
Matthew Dubourg was only 21 when this praise was lavished on him by Philip Percival, director of the State Music in Dublin. So it seems that Dubourg was already coming over to Dublin for the occasional engagement. It's an intriguing question as to why he would venture away from the busy musical life of London, a question I put to both Triona O'Hanlon and Peter Whelan.
Dublin had a busy theatre and concert schedule, so this meant there was the opportunity there to gain regular employment, and generous salaries were on offer at the city's two Anglican cathedrals, and this was very attractive for musicians and singers, and attracted many English singers to Dublin for a period of time to work and to live.
There was a lot of back and forth between London with the young Dubourg. He was in his 20s when he came over, first of all. He was playing for the aristocracy in some kind of private concerts, and he also played violin in the State Music. But when Cusser, who was his boss at the time, when he died, the job was then offered to Gemignani, who was Dubourg's teacher. And Gemignani turned it down because of his kind of Catholic background. That was his excuse he used. He didn't want to have to change religion to take the post. But more likely is that Gemignani was one of the first entrepreneurs and was really enjoying his money-making opportunities that he had in Dublin. He didn't want to be tied down by a court. Gemignani was also like a famous seller of cheap knockoff paintings as well, so he made his money that way too. But anyway, he turned down the job and he recommended his student Dubourg. And it seems from then on, from about 1728 until his death, he was travelling backwards and forwards to England, and working for Handel's orchestra and of course with the royal family in London. So he was very, very well connected by the end of his life. But another more practical reason why he might have to come to Dublin is because he had just been mugged in London and lots of gold stolen from him. So it must have been a very traumatic experience. He was held at knife point. So maybe at that point he thought maybe he should start again in a hopefully safer city like Dublin.
Indeed, it sounds like quite a vicious assault, as we hear from Dubourg's own testimony in the court.
I was coming over Lincoln's Inn Fields, and three persons came up to me and slung me down, after which they tied both my hands and legs, and one of them, that seemed like a butcher, in a white waistcoat, had a knife in his hand, and said, if I offered to make a noise, he would cut my throat. But I cannot positively say the prisoners at the bar are the persons who robbed me, but they was taken on suspicion next morning, and here are witnesses who are come to give evidence against them.
The words of Matthew Dubourg himself, describing the mugging which very likely spurred him to move more permanently to Dublin in 1728, taking on the job of Master of His Majesty's Music. I asked Claire Duff what the role of leader would have been like back then.
We don't have a conductor standing waving his arms in front of us in general, unless there's a choir or something. And in the 17th and 18th century, people generally directed from their instruments, so they could direct from the keyboard or direct from the violin. And there's something great about directing from a violin because, again, you have the bow to show the movement of when you breathe in and then you start with your bow. So the bow is almost like a little conducting stick that you can use it to be very clear. So Dubourg was a very important figure, and he was important for getting the orchestra developed in Dublin Castle.
A rigadoon from Dubourg's Dance Suite No. 3, played by the Spackling Band. It was published in 1723 in a book called A Choice Collection of the Newest Airs and Minuets. These could have been played on a variety of melody instruments, flute, oboe, violin, with continuo. Claire Duff describes the main difference between the Baroque violin and the more modern instrument.
A Baroque violin has a thicker neck and a shorter fingerboard, and that's because you would play without a chin rest and you wouldn't play as high up in the sort of 9th, 10th positions as you would with later repertoire. So you have a chunky neck to hold the violin, sort of to grip the violin, and then later on, as composers wrote more virtuosic material, then they wanted to get a slender neck so you could put your hand around the violin to reach up to the high positions, and then they also extended the fingerboard. The violin has a thinner soundpost, and basically the Baroque violin is more resonant. We have gut strings, which are just pure sheep's gut. They're not covered in metal, apart from the G string, which is covered in metal. And this creates a very, very different sound. So the strings are very sensitive. They're actually very sensitive to humidity and temperature as well, which means we should tune them more, and they can snap. But the reward you get for that is the fact that you can create a huge variety of sounds and timbres.
As well as his job directing the state band, Dubourg would have been allowed to do some freelance concerts, or nixers, as we call them today, perhaps. The benefit concert could be put on for a charity or indeed by an individual musician or singer for their own financial gain. The Mercer's Hospital benefit concerts in Dublin were particularly popular.
The inaugural Mercer's Hospital charity service took place in April 1736. The works of Handel were frequently performed at these services. Many eminent people from Dublin society sat on the board of governors and trustees, such as clergymen, members, medical doctors, people working in law and so on. And to be seen attending these charity services really reflected one's status in Dublin society. Matthew Dubourg was part of Handel's wider Anglo-Irish network, and we know from source documentation that Dubourg participated in the inaugural Mercer's Hospital charity service. Now, the documentary evidence pointing towards the fact that he participated in subsequent Mercer services is a little lacking. However, this does seem likely, given his strong associations with Handel, given his strong associations with the charity, given his standing in Dublin's cultural scene and his status within Dublin's cultural scene. And there are a number of references to Dubourg in the Mercer's Hospital administrative records. And while they don't specifically point towards his continued participation in the Mercer services, this does seem likely, given the context of these references.
An important part of Dubourg's work was to write a birthday ode every year for the King, which would be performed in Dublin Castle and often repeated a few weeks later in Fishamble Street Music Hall. So starting in 1728, Dubourg composed a total of 31 birthday odes, mainly for King George II, but later for George III and Queen Charlotte. The texts of these were hardly great literature, as their sole purpose was to praise the king.
Born to glory, sprung from praise, friend to science, temperance, truth. Well he rules, his justice sways, he's wise as age and warm as youth.
Such a large body of work, over 30 odes, you'd imagine that most of the scores might have survived. But in fact, Peter Whelan had to do a great deal of detective work to find, decipher, rehearse and record even one of these odes. Here he describes his research trail.
I expected that I would come across his music, but I thought it would be only very small fragments. That was the surprise, is when I got in touch with this musicologist called Samantha Owens, who'd been doing loads of work on this topic. But of course, that's the funny thing of it. The world of musicology and the world of performance are sometimes very divided, you know, so that they're quite ahead of us in some respects. And she's been doing wonderful work all over Europe on various different topics, but one of them it was investigating this man called Johann Sigismund Kusser, who was a student of Lully who'd come from Hungary, and he spent a lot of his life in Dublin, and he wrote these odes for the Dublin court. I encourage her to go a little bit further, and I read then, of course, about the person who was the next master of state music, who is Dubourg, so I decided maybe we should do a little bit of work on that. And Dubourg's music then was hidden in plain sight, actually. So it was in the Royal College of Music Library in London. And yeah, it was just there for hundreds of years in kind of a chaotic state, but just nobody had bothered to look at it. So I went in myself. There's a very helpful librarian there called Peter Linnett, who pointed me in the right direction for these odes. And it was just like the Indiana Jones moment, where you're presented with these four huge books of manuscripts that are all in total disarray, chaos inside. So it's just basically Dubourg's working manuscripts of these pieces. Somebody at one point obviously just threw them all together and put them in a few books, cut them whatever way they could, and said some future generation will sort this out. Some people are interested in studying the text of these court odes, which often are very embarrassing, kind of licking up to the monarch of the time. The poetry is not good at all. In fact, Jonathan Swift has a piece about birthday odes and how dreadful they are, where he just rips them apart. It's a great parody about the awful poetry for these occasions. But the music itself is very good and very charming. And just took a bit of detective work, and it was a David Rhodes, who was teaching until recently in Waterford, he helped me to kind of sort it out. We put together music with some librettis. There were some little pamphlets at the time that people would be presented when they went to these special occasions. And by working backwards from that, you could see the poetry, and then you could find the various bits of music that would correspond. So some of them are complete. There's about three or four are complete, and then many more, which stretched over a huge amount of time from the 1720s to 1760s, that still need to be put together. So this is really just a first attempt to kind of introduce people to this amazing music.
This birthday ode, called Crowned with a More Illustrious Light, was written for the King's birthday in 1739. It's quite a substantial work, about 15 minutes in duration, with three choruses, a sinfonia, four solo airs and a duet. Quite a composing feat for someone who seemed to regard himself mainly as a violinist.
He was primarily a performer, but also a composer. He was a very modest and well-liked musician as well. He never wanted to publish his own music. He probably was modest in that respect. But you know, listening to his music, and especially the court odes, like the one we reconstructed, Crowned with an Illustrious Light, there's a lot of Handel's influence there. Perhaps even Handel's leaning over his shoulder, giving him some tips on how to write this choral music. So the music itself is like strikingly Handelian. November 1741, Handel arrived in Dublin and took rooms in Abbey Street. His fortunes had been waning in London and he was looking for new career opportunities. A few weeks later, he attended the Mercer's Hospital benefit concert and began making plans for six concerts of his own music in Fishamble Hall. This visit of Handel's, which was to last 9 months, marks a high point in Dublin's musical history.
As a violinist myself, I very much enjoy playing Baroque music. I particularly enjoy Handel's music, and the works of Handel very much dominated the repertoire in 18th century Dublin. His music was written in the Italian Baroque style. The Messiah Goodbye was one of several performances that he was involved in during his time here. He benefited from two series of subscription concerts as well. And interestingly, he also participated in the Mercer's charity service, which took place on the 10th of December, 1741. And this happened shortly after his arrival in November that year. So this is significant because his participation in the Mercer's event really provided Handel with an opportunity to listen to and to assess the standard of performance in Dublin. Many of the same performers that would have participated in the Mercer's services also participated and performed in the first performance of Messiah.
In the first few months of 1742, many of Handel's major works were performed in Dublin, including Acis and Galatea, the Ode for St. Cecilia's Day, Alexander's Feast, Esther, and of course the premiere of his oratorio Messiah. Matthew Dubourg was very likely to have been involved in some or all of these performances and was the leader of the orchestra for Messiah. Handel wrote to his friend Jennings in very complimentary terms about the musicians.
The basses and countertenors are very good, and the rest of the chorus singers, by my direction, do exceedingly well. As for the instruments, they are really excellent. Mr. Dubourg being at the head of them, and the music sounds delightful in this charming room, which puts me in such spirits that I exert myself on my organ with more than usual success.
Handel and Dubourg's friendship was clearly a robust one, and the great composer wasn't afraid to poke fun at the younger one. There's a well-known musical incident associated with the two.
Dubourg was quite a famous show-off in lots of respects, and we know this because of his writing for himself in his violin concertos, and also we have this sonata by Corelli, which is written out with ornaments or graced by Mr. Dubourg, so we can see just the extent to how much he would ornament things, which is kind of like wall-to-wall carpeting of ornaments. It's very beautifully done, but he was definitely somebody who liked to embellish a lot. During one concert in Dublin, during a cadenza, or like a violin cadenza, at the end of one aria, Matthew Dubourg obviously was really in top form and started to show off and kind of got a little bit lost in his improvisations and forgot which key he was in, and it was kind of swimming around for quite a while, trying to find a way to close the cadence, find the right place to trill. And when he eventually did find the right key, Handel bellowed out at the top of his voice, "Welcome home, Mr. Dubourg," to the delight of the audience. So that was the main reason for many years how anybody knew Matthew Dubourg.
And Welcome Home, Mr. Dubourg seemed the obvious title for the Irish Baroque Orchestra's Disc of Music by Dubourg. Handel returned to London in August 1742, and his career as an oratorio composer flourished, largely because of the success of Messiah. But he wasn't the only illustrious composer to arrive in Dublin during this decade. In 1744, the composer Thomas Augustus Arne arrived in Dublin and stayed for 2 years. His sister, known as Mrs. Cibber, had been a soloist in the premiere of Messiah. Arne collaborated with Matthew Dubourg in performances of Handel's oratorios and in some of his own work. In fact, Arne's oratorio, The Death of Abel, was premiered in Dublin's Smock Alley 11 years before it was first heard in London. Arne announced that the performances would have to take place on a Saturday as...
The Mondays and Thursdays are taken up with benefits for 6 weeks. On Tuesdays are Vicar Street Consort and the Bear on College Green, which take up all the best hands. On Wednesday are the Philharmonic Society and Crow Street, where they are likewise engaged. And on Friday is Fishamble Street Consort, where they are obliged to perform.
Clearly, Dublin musicians, including Dubourg, were very busy during the concert season. Another interesting aspect of Dubourg's compositions is his use of Irish tunes and his delight in acting the part of the Irish fiddler.
Maybe it's because of his Irish heritage or this Irish mother that he had. But he seems to have been very interested in traditional Irish music. There's one anecdote where he goes to Dunboyne and he dresses up as a traditional fiddler, just as was to learn a few tunes, but they soon realise that he's got his Stradivarius, some instrument from Cremona, and that he's mobbed by the crowd when they realise that he's this famous violinist and he has to hightail it out of Dunboyne.
Having disguised himself as a country fiddler, he sallied forth amongst the tents. He was soon engaged, and a company of dancers stood up. But though he exerted himself to play in character, that is, discordantly, there was still a sweet charm in his playing that fixed his audience with rapture. At length, the crowd pressed and gazed so upon him that he thought it but wise to retire.
But we also know of his interest in Irish music. He published a few pieces with kind of Irish connections, like Eileen Aroon with variations for harpsichord, and that was an extremely popular piece in kind of Dublin concert life. You see that loads of times in newspaper reports, that was the piece that people played on all kinds of different instruments, but it was variations by Dubourg on Eileen Aroon.
Dublin audiences for these concerts largely comprise the Anglo-Irish. So we are talking about a very small group or a very small percentage of the population in society. Now, that's not to say that these audiences never heard traditional music. Traditional airs and national airs were frequently worked into variations of various types of music.
The other interesting little artifact we found was on the back of these Royal Court Odes in the Royal College of Music. Just on the reverse side of one sheet, we found this piece. It took a little bit of deciphering, but it's called Císte no Stór. And it's written in a very rough hand. It looks like he's just jotted it down, like he's copied this melody, traditional Irish melody, and he's phonetically translated the Gaelic into English on the back. It's one of the first examples anybody's found of this. It's a tune that he must have really appealed to him. And lots of people are looking at this at the moment. There's lots of hints of different carolling tunes within it. But we decided just to record it as it is, and people can make up their own minds about it.
In 1752, Dubourg was 49 then, he returned to London to direct the Prince of Wales chamber music, and some years later he became master of Her Majesty's Band of Music. He still came back to Dublin for occasional concerts and to direct the annual birthday odes, and he kept a house in the city. His former teacher, Francesco Gemignani, often stayed with him and in fact died there in 1762. Dubourg himself died 5 years later and was buried in Paddington Churchyard in London with the following epitaph.
Though sweet as Orpheus, thou couldst bring soft pleadings from the trembling string. Uncharmed the king of terror stands, nor owns the magic of thy hands.
Matthew Dubourg, 1703 to 1767. Only half Irish by birth, but active in Dublin as a composer and violinist for most of his career. We can certainly include him among the roll call of significant Irish musicians of the 18th century. I asked Peter Whelan to sum up his musical character.
Dubourg's music is kind of easy listening music in a lot of respects. He's writing to please his public, and he's writing to show his violin playing to the best advantage, as a show-off or otherwise. But I think that's one of the reasons he was well-liked, is that he's always writing for the public. He's a very good sense of who he's writing for. If you take, for instance, the music of his predecessor, Kusser, who came from studying in Versailles, his music is extremely intricate and... it's brilliant music, but very dense, and he was a very difficult personality. He always fell out with the musicians he's working for, demanding really high levels. And you can see that in the music. It's really dense, and it takes a lot of kind of concentration and a lot of goodwill to tease it out. I think it's definitely worthwhile. But Dubourg's music is much easier, and you see... we hardly have any records of Kusser in society, because I think he was a trickier person, but Dubourg was like charming and witty and a man of the people, I think.
Claire Duff, leader of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, really enjoyed recording the disc, and one track in particular caught her fancy.
Well, I really enjoyed the vocal pieces like Hibernian's Sons, Your Voice is Raised, but I also enjoyed just the fun of the Dubourg's Maggot, which was clearly very, very, very popular at the time, and you can kind of see why, because it's very catchy.
We have so much information from the time in the buildings in Ireland, these beautiful Georgian structures, but for me it's never complete unless you can hear it as well. So this is why it's such a passion for me, and it's so rewarding to just hear the soundtrack to the Georgian buildings and Georgian Dublin and Ireland. And I guess that was always kind of what kind of propelled me forward. Of course, always interested in Baroque music, but it's especially rewarding when you can bring it home and kind of own it and find that it's part of your own heritage. For many people, classical music in Ireland, anyways, is a foreign export. But all of this proves that we have hundreds and hundreds of years of our own heritage in classical music. So I find that a very rewarding thing to share with other people.
Your voice is me. Hibernia's Sun, Your Voice's Rays from Ode to Dublin Castle by Matthew Duborg, performed by the Irish Baroque Orchestra and Chorus under artistic director Peter Whelan, ending that programme Master of the Music, which was presented by Maura Nick Garralt. The contributors were Peter Whelan, violinist Claire Duff and musicologist Triona O'Hanlon. The reader was Paddy Lynch and the producer is Joe O'Doul. The programme is a Pine Valley production for RTE Lyric FM and was first broadcast in 2019. The album Welcome Home, Mr. Duborg by the Irish Baroque Orchestra is available on Lynn Records. Coming up sometime this autumn, Michael Lee will have another programme on a new album by the Irish Baroque Orchestra when he looks at The Trials of Tenducci, the story of a celebrated castrato who came to Ireland and, well, you'll find out in autumn. On next week's Lyric Feature, we turn to poetry, where Francis Ledwidge is the subject in Claire Cunningham's programme, When the War is Over. That's next Sunday on the Lyric Feature at 6 p.m.